This week, U.S. Vice President calls copyright infringement theft in private meeting with copyright industry. Hollywood Post record-breaking year in 2009 despite cries of piracy. And national firewall planned for Australia. This is Pirate Party Radio, episode 8 for Thursday, December 17th, 2009.
On 10th of November, I released an expression of interest seeking the participation of ISPs and mobile telephone operators in this live pilot. The pilot will test filtering specifically against the ACMA blacklist of prohibited internet content, which is mostly child pornography, as well as filtering of other unwanted content. While the ACMA blacklist is currently around 1,300 URLs, the pilot will test against this list, as well as filtering for a range of URLs to around 10,000, so that the impact on network performance of a larger blacklist can be examined. The live pilot will provide valuable real-world evidence on the potential impacts on internet speeds and costs to industry, and will help ensure we implement a filtering solution that is efficient, effective and easy for Australian families to use.
Will the Minister provide us a definition of what he meant by unwanted content and where we might find a definition of unwanted? Will the Minister acknowledge the legitimate concerns that have been raised by commentators and many members of the public that such a system will degrade internet performance, prove costly and inefficient, and do very little to achieve the government's policy objectives? And furthermore, that the government's proposal for dynamic filtering is the equivalent of the post office being required to open every single piece of mail.
We are under siege. They are doing everything they can to prevent progress, to prevent the spread of culture, and to prevent privacy as we know it. The only way to stop this is to unite. This is definitely a global movement. It's continuing to spread across the world like wildfire. We are seeing the birth of a new global political power. There's no way to control the information. There's no way to control culture, control knowledge. And those who control culture and knowledge control the world. And that is losing its last cohorts. People don't understand how big this really is.
I'm James O'Brien, and welcome to Pirate Party Radio, your source for news on copyright, net neutrality, open government, free culture and speech, patents, privacy, and more. Make sure you check out the Pirate Party Radio forums for links to all the news stories mentioned during the show, and check out the Pirate Party Radio website at piratepartyradio.com. The intro you heard at the top of the show was a sample taken from a conversation between Senator Ludlam and Minister Conroy in the Australian Senate, and I've linked to that off the Pirate Party Radio forums. It's off a YouTube link. We've got an incoming message. This is from Golden Ratio 09. This is regarding Time Warner's browser hijacking escapades in Episode 7. He says, I myself have never experienced such a situation, so perhaps it's just something that's being tried out. For now, at least, I just wanted to make a quick comment about the legal ramifications you were mulling over. Frankly, that's exactly what they're doing. This will almost certainly keep his concession of guilt on file, so if or when this makes its way to a court of law, they will be able to come right out and say that he already knew about peer-to-peer file sharing and that his computer had been used to share copyrighted material. And from there, it would be an extraordinarily easy case to make against him, regardless of whether he can prove that he has taken steps against the issue or not. I would be shocked if he doesn't find himself on the defending side of a lawsuit in the next few years because of it. The best idea to anyone on the receiving end of the letter would be to try and get the letter off of your browser in any manner besides clicking on the link at the top. I'm sure there's some sort of link at the bottom, it takes you to more information about the evils of file sharing. Oh no, etc. But whatever you do, do not click the link, or it will almost certainly be used as evidence against you. And he followed up with another letter saying, another quick thought following from the last comment. I was assuming that there was another option to get out of the letter. However, if the only way to close the letter is to click the link at the top, it's not quite as malicious as I said before. Certainly it's not great, and they might file a lawsuit because of it, but one could argue that they had no choice but to select the link. So, as it were, be forced, I would think that it would lose its potency as evidence in a trial. And so rightly, if that's all you have to click is the one button to continue on with your internet service, it would be seen as less an admission of guilt and more as you're being forced to click the button. You're being coerced almost into admitting your guilt or admitting that you know what's going on, even if you're not doing it. Of course, the other alternative is to cancel your ISP. But in some places around the world, you only have one option. So to cancel your ISP is to cancel your internet altogether, which is not really much of an option whatsoever. And if you'd like to contact me or ask a question or leave a comment, just head over to the Pirate Party radio site, piratepartyradio.com, and fill out the feedback form. And we'll get on to the news. News from Australia. Big Brother laws to be brought in for web. This is from theage.com.au. The federal government will block selected online sites after trials found filtering was inaccurate, and would not slow down the internet. But critics, including the online users lobby group Electronic Frontiers Australia and the Greens communications spokesman Scott Ludlam, said the trials results were not surprising and the policy was still flawed. Communication Minister Stephen Conroy, who you'd heard at the top of the show, said yesterday he would introduce legislation just before next year's election to make internet service providers block a blacklist of refused classification websites. The blacklist, featuring material such as child sex abuse, sexual violence, and instructions on crime, will be compiled using a public complaints mechanism, government censors, and web addresses provided by international agencies. Euthanasia advocate and director of Exit International, Dr. Philip Nitschke, said the proposals were the final nail in the coffin for euthanasia advocacy in Australia, where people are banned from discussing end-of-life issues over the phone, buying books about it, or importing printed material on it. The one avenue we had to open to us was the internet, and now it looks like it will be part of Conroy's grand plan to provide a so-called clean feed to Australia, he said. It's outrageous. Senator Conroy released results of a pilot trial of internet filters by NX Test Lab, which found that the blocking banned material was accurate and had little impact on internet speed. Most Australians acknowledge that there's some internet material which is not acceptable in any civilized society, he said. It is important that all Australians, particularly young children, are protected. About 15 Western countries had encouraged or enforced internet filtering, and there was no reason why Australians should not have a similar protection, he said. It is not clear how or if the filters will distinguish between banned material that is illegal and that is which is legal. A version of the government's list of banned sites were leaked on the web in March, revealing the scope of the filtering could extend significantly beyond child porn. About half were not related to child porn and include links to poker sites, YouTube, gay and straight porn sites, Wikipedia, euthanasia sites, fringe religions, fetish sites, Christian sites, a tour operator, and a Queensland dentist. Given the pilot's modest goals, it was designed from the beginning to pass, said Electronic Frontiers Australia spokesman Colin Jacobs. Although it may address some technical issues, what it leaves out is far more important. Exactly what will be blocked, who will decide, and why it's being attempted in the first place. The pilot trial report noted that government could that people could circumvent any internet filters with ease. Senator Conroy said the government would begin public consultations today with the release of a discussion paper on ways to improve the accountability of process that led to the sites being put on the blacklist. Options included appeal mechanisms, notification to website owners, and review by an independent expert. So, Australia is getting locked down by their government on which sites they can and cannot see, joining such wonderful places such as China and Iran and other countries that censor the internet on behalf of its citizens because it does not trust its population to govern itself in information that it's seeking out. Now, the worst part of this is that they won't tell you which sites are on the list. They won't tell you what is censored and what's not. They won't give you the list. Well, they'll defend themselves saying, well, we can't give you the list because then you'll know what's blocked and you'll want to go to those sites. Well, I say good luck to the Australians, and there's get involved in Australian Pirate Party, and I'm sure they'll be able to give you some more information on how they are heading up the fight against this kind of censorship, and also get in contact with Electronic Frontiers Australia. And they'll probably be able to fill you in on who to write to if you're an Australian listener, a Pirate Party member, and how to get in contact with your local government to tell them of your opinion on how the government is deciding things for you, which sites to see or not to see. Legal or not legal, they're banning sites that are completely legal within the legal realms of the Australian law system. So, I would be terribly upset if something like this came into Canada where I live. So, get involved. In open government and copyright news out of the U.S., White House summit with entertainment executives. This is from MaineJustice.com. Vice President Joe Biden led a roundtable meeting of high-ranking government officials and entertainment industry executives at the White House Conference Center today, where he pledged that the Obama administration would work to combat piracy in the rapidly changing technological age. Attorney General Eric Holder and the FBI Director Robert Mueller were just two of the officials in attendance at the meeting, which the White House billed as the first of its kind. Others included Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano, Commerce Secretary Gary Locke, Senior Advisor Valerie Jarrett, and Secret Service Director Mark Sullivan. This is a problem that the United States cannot solve by itself, said Holder. We want to confront these nations, quite frankly, where there too much of this occurs. Holder announced that the Justice Department would be setting up an intellectual property enforcement training and technical assistance program to provide resources to train the state and local officials on how to investigate and prevent intellectual property crimes. While the FBI has been offering such training previously, Biden said that this is the first time that the government has been making a coordinated effort, which he called long overdue. Biden said he was offended by the violation of copyrights, which he called flat, unadulterated theft, which he said it was important to get all the major players in one place, all the major players in one place, in one room, with one overall, overarching strategy on how to deal with what is serious problem facing this country. In a statement, the Motion Pictures Association of America said, "We especially appreciate the Vice President's long history of support for the protection of intellectual property and thank him for his continued leadership defending American workers and businesses." "I've been in this battle with y'all since I don't know how long," said Biden. "The problem has gotten worse. Intellectual piracy is costing this country and all of you," referring to all the industry leaders, "billions of dollars and thousands of jobs unless we better coordinate with all the resources of the federal government to deal with this problem. It's likely to only get worse." Holder said that he would reinvigorate a DOJ task force on the enforcement of intellectual property rights. "We wanted to convene an international meeting to start work with our international partners," said Holder. At the conclusion of the remarks by the government officials, press members were escorted out of the room before the conversation with the industry officials began. CEOs declined to speak with a small group of reporters when they emerged over 50 minutes later, a half hour longer than anticipated. One consumer group, Public Knowledge, said it was extremely disappointed to learn of the White House meeting to be held later today on the issue of intellectual property and piracy, according to Daily Finance. No consumer or public interest groups, technology companies, technology associates, or internet service providers are on the guest list, said Gigi Sohan, Sohn, president of Public Knowledge. No one who questions the need for draconian governmental policies on behalf of the privileged special interest group for whom this meeting is being held is on the guest list. So the people that were in attendance were a number of government officials. It goes on to list in the story all the people in attendance. So a bunch of government officials, Sony, and people from the industry, including people from Sony Pictures Entertainment, Warner Brothers Entertainment, Time Warner, Viacom, NBC Universal, Warner Music Group, HarperCollins, Universal Music Group, Walt Disney Company, MPAA, RIAA, Directors Guild of America. The list goes on and on. The BSA, Business Software Alliance, Entertainment Software Alliance, a whole bunch of people in the industry, but only on one side of the industry that are have a stake in their intellectual property, but nobody from the other side of the fence who represents the people, the public, ISPs, people who have an interest in being able to have this information free for public use after a certain amount of time, which is like 70 or 90 years now, but there still needs to be a voice there. But everybody was escorted out of the building. So this is a secret meeting between the government and the corporations. Well, so much for open government. So we can't even find out what's going on where they're spending our money to enforce copyrights on behalf of the corporations. So hopefully details of that meeting get leaked somehow, hopefully on WikiLeaks or somewhere we can access it so we know what our government is doing. Not my government, but the U.S. government. So people in the U.S. know what is happening. ACTA, a global threat to freedom. Speaking of global copyright protections, this is from laquadrature.net. A worldwide coalition on non-governmental organizations, consumer unions, and online service providers associations publish an open letter to the European institutions regarding the Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement, ACTA, currently under negotiations. They call on the European Parliament and the EU negotiators to oppose any provision into the multilateral agreement that would undermine the fundamental rights and freedoms of citizens in Europe and across the world. By December 17th, 2009, European negotiators will submit their position regarding the proposal put forward by the U.S. trade representatives for the international chapter of the ACTA. It's now time for the European Union to firmly oppose these dangerous measures secretly being negotiated. They cover not only three strike schemes, but also include internet service providers' liability that would result in internet filtering and dispositions undermining interoperability and usability of digital music and films. The first signatories of the open letter include Consumers International, World Federation of 220 Consumer Groups in 115 countries, EDRI, 27 European Civil Rights and Privacy NGOs, the Free Software Foundation, Electronic Frontier Foundation, ASIC, French Trade Association for Web 2.0 Companies, and civil liberties organizations from all around Europe, 9 member states so far. The letter is open for signature by other organizations. And it states, ACTA, a global threat to freedoms, open letter. The Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement, ACTA, is a broad intergovernmental agreement under negotiation ranging from the key social issues of access to medicine to criminal internet regulation. We fear it could seriously hinder European innovation in the digital single market while undermining federal rights and democracy at large. The negotiation process itself raises important questions of transparency and due democratic process, given that the content of the draft agreement has been kept secret for more than 18 months. Although some details about the proposal recently leaked to the public, more worrying still, while the European Parliament has been denied access to the documents, U.S. industry has been granted access to them. albeit only after signing non-disclosure agreements. A recent analysis by the European Commission of the ACTA Internet chapter proves that the topics under discussion go far beyond the current body of EU law. More importantly, the Commission's analysis confirms that the current draft of ACTA would profoundly restrict the fundamental rights and freedoms of European citizens, most notably the freedom of expression and communication privacy. These are very much at risk, since the current draft pushes for the implementation of three-strike schemes and content filtering policies by seeking to impose civil and criminal liability on technical intermediaries and such as internet service providers. The text would also radically erode the exercise of interoperability that is essential for both consumer rights and competitiveness. Consequently, we urge the Parliament to call on European negotiators to establish transparency in the negotiation process and publish the draft agreement, and not to accept any proposal which would undermine citizens' rights and freedoms. Furthermore, we urge the Parliament to make an unequivocal statement to the Commission and Council that any agreement which does not respect these core principles would force the Parliament to reject the entire text. So they'll be sending that out this Thursday. So if you have not, or by the time you hear this, unfortunately, it'll already be sent. I didn't catch it last week. So hopefully any organizations that you might be associated with have already signed on to this letter to forward it to the European Union to let them know how serious that this is and how it threatens the rights and freedoms of people in the European Union. And this is copyright news from New Zealand. After delay, Kiwis to get kinder, gentler three strikes policy. And this is from ArsTechnica.com. New Zealand has introduced a rewrite of copyright laws section 92A, the infamous bit of legalese that was to bring three strikes rules and internet disconnections to the Kiwis. The new rules remove guilt by association and make it more difficult for rights holders to fine or disconnect suspected file swappers. The original Section 92A was scrapped back in March after widespread opposition. Users and ISPs were most concerned that the rules would apparently disconnect even huge businesses after a few employees downloaded illicit files. The high-profile judge raised concerns that the procedure could run afoul of contract law in New Zealand. ISPs weren't keen on disconnecting their own customers for the benefit of one set of industries, and they couldn't believe that the law provided no indemnification from lawsuits. The ISP could be both sued by users and rights holders if they didn't like the way it was being handled by the Three Strikes program. And users wanted some form of third-party or judicial arbitration before any internet disconnection. To its credit, the government pulled its proposal. Took more than half a year to work on it and has revised the process. Under the new rules, rights holders can now notify ISP about alleged infringement, and ISPs will forward those notices to subscribers called notice and notice. After three such letters, rights holders can choose to go to a special copyright tribunal to seek a fine, or go to court to seek a disconnection of up to 6 months. The plan removes ISPs from the role of playing internet cop, and it also provides for counter notices, appeals, and some sort of judicial oversight of sanctions. Internet NZ, which runs the NZ domain system, said today that it was pleased with the revisions. The law will be introduced early in 2010. Now, I have a couple questions about this. Now, they say that they're going to be forwarding on these notices to the customers of the ISP. Now, and after three notices, they are able to, the copyright holders are able to go to a copyright tribunal or to court to seek a disconnection or a fine. Now, my question is, how do they know they've made it up to the three strikes? Are these anonymous notices being sent on and the copyright holder has no knowledge of the name and address, etc., of the person supposedly infringing on the copyright? Or does the ISP forward back the information to the copyright holder? And if it is anonymous, does the ISP say this anonymous person is now on his second strike? This anonymous person is now on its third strike? And then the copyright holders have to go to the court to get a warrant to get the name and address, etc., of the copyright holder. Now, if anybody out there knows this information, please let me know, because it doesn't say it in the story. This privacy news from Canada. Facebook phone app collects non-users' contact information. And I say from Canada because it's reported on by the CBC, and there's a lot of Facebook privacy information, Facebook privacy concerns that was put forward by the Canadian government recently. A screenshot showing information about a Facebook's contact application is shows on the webpage. A Facebook feature for cell phones is providing the company with a record of personal information about people who don't use the social networking site. The contact application is offered for BlackBerries as well for Palm and Android 2-based phones. Once enabled on a user's phone, it allows Facebook to upload all the names, email addresses, and phone numbers from the phone's contact list. The purpose is to synchronize a user's cell phone address book with the information in their friends' Facebook accounts. Once the phone uploads its full contact list, Facebook servers match the information with profiles on current Facebook users. The application then downloads any missing content about a person's Facebook friends to the phone's address book, such as names, profile pictures, and email addresses, phone numbers, and birthdays. The synchronization also gives Facebook a copy of the contact information from the phone for people who have never signed up or used the social networking site. In response to a July 16, 2009 report by Canada's Privacy Commissioner that found Facebook wasn't complying with some elements of Canada privacy law, the social networking site agreed to make changes within a year in several areas, including preventing games, quizzes, and other applications developed by third parties from accessing information until it obtains express consent for each category of personal information. Users' friends will also be able to block applications from accessing their information, which it doesn't do in this case. Also, next one, making it clear to users that they can either deactivate or delete their accounts, whereby only deleting will remove the information entirely. Reminding users that they need to ensure that they have the consent of non-users before sharing the non-users' email addresses with Facebook, which it's not doing in this case. Clarifying its privacy policy that it will retain a user's profile after the user dies so friends can post comments and pay tribute. So they're violating, in my opinion, it looks like, two of the policies that was set forth by Canada's Privacy Commissioner on July 16, 2009 with this third-party Facebook application, which Facebook is complying with trading information back and forth with this third-party app. It goes on to say, we store a copy of the phone's local address on Facebook, confirmed Debbie Frost, Director of Global Communications and Public Affairs at Facebook. The information is stored on Facebook servers to facilitate the matching algorithm, which is too heavy to run on the phone. If it's too heavy to run on the phone, that's the third party's applications developer's problem. It is not Facebook's problem by facilitating them to be able to store third people's information that they never agreed to with Facebook. People who've never even visited the Facebook site has information about themselves, their name, their picture, their phone number stored on Facebook server without their permission. And they're giving the excuse that because the phone can't handle the load, that they have to store the information. I digress and go on. If we waited to get that information as people join Facebook or match the contacts one by one, it would literally suck the phone book's entire battery and cost a fortune. That's why we take them all, she said, referring to a phone's contact entries for both Facebook users and those without accounts. Facebook is assuming that everybody in the world is going to be joining Facebook eventually. They said if we waited to get that information as people joined Facebook, it would literally suck the phone's entire battery and cost a fortune. So their excuse for violating Canada's proposed privacy information proposal is because people's phone batteries are going to die is the weakest excuse I've ever heard for privacy. It's pathetic, in fact. We're going to violate your privacy because some other person's phone battery's going to die and it costs them a fortune. Well, really, that's the problem for the person that has downloaded this third-party app and wants to use it to synchronize their friends and family who has not given their permission to violate their privacy. And Facebook is going to go ahead and do it for them. The information about both Facebook members and non-users stays on Facebook servers after the matching algorithm has run and the synchronization is complete. The company says it archives the information about non-Facebook users in case they eventually decide to sign up for a Facebook account. This information is not shared with any other user on Facebook and is not shared with any other third party. Well, besides the one of the application that you're using to upload it, to completely delete the uploaded contact information that is kept on the Facebook server, a user would need to remove the Facebook application from their phone. It is important to note that if you don't want the Facebook to store that, or if you want to delete the feature, you can, and we delete the information. So a question is that if your phone dies and the program that you use to upload this, your friend's information to Facebook is gone, how are you ever going to delete that information off Facebook servers? That while Facebook servers are waiting for this delete command to magically come from your phone that may or may not exist anymore. So if your phone dies, it's on my phone number and my information that my friend has uploaded without my permission is now on Facebook's site, and they're storing it indefinitely because their phone died. Weak excuse. Once a program has been removed from a smartphone, Facebook says it takes a few weeks for the information for it to be completely deleted from its servers. Facebook is used by 12 million Canadians and 200 million people worldwide. Earlier this year, it came under fire for some of the ways it handles data collected and stored by its network. For example, Facebook shared its users' personal information with third-party sites in a way that breached Canadian privacy law, according to a report by the Office of the Privacy Commissioner of Canada, released July 16th. Facebook updated its privacy policy in October this year with some changes based on recommendations filed by Canada's Privacy Commissioner. The Office of the Privacy Commissioner of Canada is reviewing the new Facebook policy outlined on the Facebook's website, according to Anne-Marie Hayden, a spokeswoman for the Federal Privacy Commissioner. The Privacy Commissioner has not had a complaint about Facebook's contact synchronization application, Hayden said. She added that the commissioner had investigated another Facebook feature that let its members tag photos with the names of non-Facebook users. It was concluded that it was the responsibility of the member and Facebook itself to get consent of the non-member. So a lot of supposed violations going on by Facebook and third-party programs that are uploading non-users' private information to Facebook, which will store it indefinitely unless this phone deletes it off of there, and even then it says it takes weeks to delete it, which is beyond me why it would take weeks. It doesn't make any sense. This is a computer, and they said it's supposedly faster than your phone, so why is it taking weeks to delete it off their server? Baffling. Copyright news out of the Netherlands. Anti-piracy group wants to ban you from talking about Usenet. It's from torrentfreak.com. The first rule of Usenet is that you don't talk about Usenet. This rule kept Usenet providers and users out of sight from anti-piracy organizers for years. Ironically, the Dutch anti-piracy outfit Brin are now the first ones trying to enforce this rule in court. The Usenet Commission FTD allows its nearly 500,000 members to discuss and report location of material they find on Usenet without explicitly linking to the copyrighted content. The operators of the site see no harm in what they do, but according to Dutch anti-piracy organization Brin, online communities should not be entitled to allow these kinds of discussions on their website. Talking about copyrighted content on Usenet is illegal, they argue, and Brian wants FTD to be shut down for allowing this. The news group community, however, is not prepared to tolerate Brian's accusations and has decided to take action. Earlier this year, FTD took Brienne to court, demanding that it should retract its numerous statements that FTD operates illegally. In a letter to the court in this ongoing case, FTD's lawyer, Anoud Engelfreit, stated yesterday that Brienne is going too far with its statements. Downloading copyrighted files and music for personal use is perfectly legal in the Netherlands. He sees no reason why merely talking about it should be illegal. FTD users do not make files available and are therefore not acting against the law. Hyperlinks, torrents, NZB files, and other technical possibilities to download copyrighted works are not provided. Brienne said in effect that it should be forbidden to talk about downloading material, Engelfreit added. Undeterred, Brienne maintained their stance and declared FTD a criminal operation. In a counterclaim against FTD, the anti-piracy outfit has demanded $70,000 a day in penalties if the Usenet chatter continues. Needless to say, if Brienne wins their case, this will have serious implications for many other websites and communities, including Torrent Freak. Simply mentioning that a movie, such as 2012, can be downloaded through BitTorrent would no longer be allowed, according to Engelfreit. FTD's lawyer is confident about the positive outcome of the case, arguing that FTD is operating within the boundaries of Dutch copyright law. We fully expect to win our case. Brienne is big on statements, but often short on facts and legal arguments to back them up, Engelfreit told Torrent Freak earlier, adding that they have the law and the facts on their side. The verdict in this case is expected to be announced sometime next year. Until then, here's our Usenet tutorial. So, Brienne is trying to stifle free speech, even talking about the possibility of downloading a copyrighted file will now be illegal in Brienne's eyes. Now, this is going well beyond what I'm sure Brienne is supposed to be doing as an organization, protecting the artist's rights against people copying copyrighted works. So that's a definite court case to be watching out for. Privacy's news out of Sweden. New Swedish surveillance draft legislation leaks. This is from ZeroPaid.com. The last time Swedish lawmakers pushed for new surveillance legislation, it sparked massive protests from its citizens. So it may come to a surprise to Swedish citizens that lawmakers are gearing up for a second round of surveillance laws that would strip out some of the legal safeguards put in place from the first rounds of surveillance laws. WikiLeaks have just posted an unreleased draft of legislation that would put in more surveillance on Swedish network traffic. The safeguards that were put in place was that the police would not have a direct access to the massive amounts of intercepted data flowing through the networks. The main concern back in 2008, when laws such as the Lex Orwell laws were being discussed, was that a vast amount of internet traffic would flow through Swedish networks and become subject to this law. Now it turns out that this legislation is aimed squarely at the fact that the police would not have direct access to the vast amounts of data being collected. The draft is not in English, but WikiLeaks was kind enough to offer the following synopsis of this leak. The file presents a draft law for internet and telephony spying from the Swedish Department of Justice. The document was mentioned but not released by Svenska Dagbladet on December 12, 2009. The legislation is aimed at giving Swedish police and domestic intelligence the power to automatically intercept internet traffic that passes through Sweden. After a heated debate, a related mass surveillance law was passed late last year, allowing the Swedish National Radio Defense Establishment, Sweden's NSA, to intercept internet traffic. About 80% of regular Russian internet traffic as of December 2008 passes through Sweden, giving Sweden a bulk intelligence exchange position with the internet with the United States and other powers. One condition of the 2008 legislation was that the police should not have access to the defense system. WikiLeaks also suggests that the law would be quickly tabled and ran through whatever parliamentary procedures there are with next to no public discussion. Given how there was an entire campaign to stop the legislation last time, it's not a surprise that the Swedish government has opted to try this tactic if they wanted to pass such legislation when there's so much distaste for anything seen as anti-privacy. The leak clearly shows that somebody internally isn't happy that there's been such an attempt in the first place to prevent public debate. And there's a link to the campaign site against the last surveillance legislation in Sweden, if you want to go to the news story and take a look at that. In copyright news from Canada, record store owner pleads guilty to Copyright Act charge over bootleg CDs. And this is from the OttawaCitizen.com, and it's not as straightforward as you might think. An Ottawa record store owner grudgingly pleaded guilty to a single charge under the Canadian Copyright Act, then took a reluctant pause before admitting to possessing 100 legal CDs discovered in an RCMP raid earlier this year. "I can't afford to fight it. It's such a shame," David Nolan said outside the courtroom, adding he felt ripped off. RCMP raided Nolan Wellington Street record shop Legend Records in April 2009 after an undercover agent bought CDs in January. Agents from the Canadian Recording Industry Association, CRIA, subsequently said that the CDs violated Canadian copyright law. RCMP seized about 500 CDs in the April raid. About 200 were returned to Nolan, leaving 294 CDs that were deemed to be in contravention of Canada copyright law. Many of these CDs were not illegal at all, Nolan's lawyer Mark Lazarevitz said, including albums by local group The Townsmen that Nolan helped finance. The final figure of the 100 illegal CDs was somewhat arbitrary figure acceptable to Larovitz and the Crown attorney Rob Sisgo. Nolan said he often tracked down rare CDs that are unavailable in North America to satisfy his customer. Often the original copyright holders are dead. Lazarevitz said Nolan's collection of 500,000 to a million recordings, which also include vinyl, is 99.9% legitimate, and that it makes little sense to go after a man who is essentially supporting the record industry when illegally downloaded music is rampant. The joint agreement between the defense and the Crown gives Nolan 3 months to make a $1,000 donation to the charity of his choice. He is to appear in court again on April 1st. So, these CDs that he's being charged over are not available in North America. They don't exist in North America. They have never entered legally into North America through any record label. So, and also, the original copyright holders are dead. So this is really a stance against copyright that he is taking. Because there is no way to get these CDs, how are the people in Canada even able to listen to this music outside of Canada? I mean, inside Canada. There's no legal way to listen to this music that he's providing to his customers. Now, selling this music is a bit of shaky ground, in my opinion. But being able to provide this music that in no other way is legally able to obtain it, he's doing a service to these people, these bands that are not able to get into Canada any other way. The free speech news from the U.S. message board poster faces baseless lawsuit for criticizing USA Technologies. The Electronic Frontier Foundation has asked a federal judge in San Francisco to quash a baseless subpoena aimed at outing an anonymous online critic of a Pennsylvania company called USA Technologies. A hearing in the case is set for Friday. Earlier this year, EFF's client, Yahoo user Stuck Clerk, posted to the Yahoo message board dedicated to the company, criticizing USA Technology and its CEO George Jensen Jr. for plummeting stock prices, high compensation rates for executives, and a consistent lack of profitability. Another anonymous poster had similar complaints. In a response, USA Technology filed suit in the Eastern District of Pennsylvania, alleging that the statements violated federal securities regulations because they are part of a scheme for the authors to enrich themselves through undisclosed manipulative trading tactics. USA Technology also alleged that the online posts were defamatory. As part of the lawsuit, USA Technologies issued a subpoena out of the Northern District of California to Yahoo, asking for the critics' identities. The First Amendment protects the right to speak anonymously, so people can express their views without fear of retribution or reprisal, said EFF senior staff attorney Mark Zimmerman. USA Technologies may not appreciate the glare of such public criticism, but internet users like StockClerk have a right to post such criticism in a public forum. The First Amendment protects the right to speak anonymously, especially about matters of public concern, such as the performance of management of publicly traded companies. In addition, several state legislatures, including California, passed laws to further protect individuals against lawsuits targeting them for exercising First Amendment rights. In its reply brief filed Friday, EFF underscores the problems with the USA Technologies lawsuits, and it asks the court to block attempts to enforce Yahoo's subpoena. So they're trying to quash this company, USA Technologies, is trying to quash any complaints online about its company. Now, this is a chilling effect on anybody critical of companies. If this lawsuit passes and goes through and they're able to silence and get the identities of these critics online. So I can see this going further to anybody being able to, anybody posting something disparagingly about a company, even to the point of a bad review of a product, people would be scared of being sued. Now, these people are anonymous. Imagine what people think when they're not anonymous posting disparaging comments about their product in a review on a website or in a magazine. Now, especially about USA Technologies, now that their name is out there. So there's something to be said about USA Technologies and how scared they are about what's being said about them online. I'm not sure what USA Technologies makes, but maybe take a look and see what they do make. This next one, open government news from Canada. Canada dragging its feet on open data initiatives. This is from thestar.com. Earlier this year, I wrote about, not me, but this writer, I wrote about the budding momentum behind governments making their data more readily available to the public for reuse. Open data initiatives had generated dozens of commercial and non-commercial websites that add value to the government data. Some make data more understandable by making you enter into active interactive maps to provide visuals about where activities are taking place, government stimulus spending. Others make the data more accessible by offering services to customize or deliver government information. For example, postal codes to allow public interest groups to launch advocacy campaigns. The crucial aspect behind these initiatives is that the government makes the data available in open formats free from restrictive licenses, so companies and civil society groups can create innovative websites, tools, and online services. Last week, the global open data movement received a big boost in three countries that is sure to leave Canadians wondering why their government has been so slow in this issue. The U.S. issued its much anticipated open government directive, instructing every federal department and agencies to take specific actions to open its operations to the public. Rather than simply identifying principles, the directive issues strict timelines for action. For example, it required agencies to publish information online in an open format that can be retrieved, downloaded, indexed, and searched by commonly used web search applications. An open format is one that is platform independent, machine readable, and made available to the public without restrictions that would impede the reuse of that information. Each agency is required to publish at least three data sets within 45 days to establish an open government section on its website. Not to be outdone, the Australian Government 2.0 Task Force issued its draft report on how to make government information more accessible and usable. The task force starting premise is that public sector information is a national resource, and that releasing as much of it on a permissive terms and possible will maximize its economic and social value and reinforce a healthy democracy. And it goes on to say the British government is also taking steps to put forth open initiatives for data that the government released. So I applaud those three countries, Australia, US, and Britain, for making their government data in open formats that anybody is able to read and massage and re-release in a more readable format, possibly. So this is critical of the Canadian government to step up and do the same thing. And we need to really step it up to get in line with some more for more open government so that the common man can access information from their own government. And this is next one's from Privacy News from the U.S. Text message case could redefine workplace privacy. This is from NPR.org. California police officer Jeff Kwan said he believed that hundreds of personal text messages he'd sent with his work-issued pager, including sexual explicit notes to his mistress, were private. After all, the Ontario Police Department, where the married Kwan is a SWAT team sergeant, had told him and others that the electronic missives wouldn't be reviewed if officers reimbursed the department for charges beyond what the city's text service contract allowed. But when police officials eventually decided to review the text of heavy users like Kwan, ostensibly to determine if the service contract needed to be expanded to accommodate work-related text, they set off a legal battle over workplace privacy in the digital world that has now reached the U.S. Supreme Court. At issue is whether the constitutional privacy rights extend to text messages sent by public employees on work-issued communication devices, and how far government employees may go in writing policies that limit those rights. Whatever the court decides next year could have broad privacy repercussions for public employees who use work-issued communication devices and their employers who write rules for usage. There's a cry for clarity in this area, says Evans Anya Wu, a New Jersey lawyer who specializes in internet law. The Supreme Court case that established an employee's reasonable right to expect privacy in the workplace and an employer's companion right to intrude if the circumstances warrant is more than 2 decades old. And that decision in O'Connor versus Ortega, which involved a physical search of a public hospital doctor's office, were rendered long before email, texting, and tweeting became the coins of the work communications realm. A lot has happened in 2 decades, and Yawu says, in the digital era, O'Connor has a problem. Kwan's case once appeared to be a clumsy vehicle for a privacy dispute because, at the time of the texting controversy, the Ontario Police Department essentially had two policies on personal use of city-owned computer equipment and email services. A written policy permitted only limited personal use of equipment, but Kwan and other officers had been told verbally that there was no examination of personal versus work of their pager texts if they paid the overages. So this is really a good test of what is personal and what is examinable by your employer. Personally, I wouldn't send anything that is personal through work because I would assume that anything sent over an email at work, even using like a Yahoo site or Hotmail, could be examined by because it does travel through the work's proxy. I would assume that it would be examinable by my employer. So I would be very careful to, in the future, anybody there that's working in when they're using any kind of work-related technology device is to not send personal stuff. Now, has anybody out there experienced this kind of thing where they've been approached by their work in terms of something that they've sent through work that is of a personal nature? And they've been questioned on it when they've been previously told that it's okay to send that kind of stuff. Or do you just not do it at all? Just like I do. I don't even send it. I'm very, very careful about that. So this is going to be a really good test of somebody that was told they could do it, but then in the end, they're actually being examined for it and their texts are being looked at. Very scary indeed when they're saying one thing and doing another. This next one, copyright news from the U.S. Hollywood sets $10 billion box office record sent in by Epix. And so, well, I'll read it first. TorrentFreak.com, this was posted on, claims by the MPAA that illegal downloads are killing the industry and causing billions in losses are once again being shredded. In 2009, the leading Hollywood studios made more films and generated more revenue than ever before. For the first time in history, the domestic box office grosses will surpass $10 billion. Nearly all the major BitTorrent sites have seen their visitors' numbers go up through this year, and many of these new visitors are looking to download Hollywood's latest releases. This development is a thorn in the side of MPAA, movie bosses, and some filmmakers, who repeatedly claim that the pirated downloads are killing the movie industry. Despite these worries, neither the ever-increasing piracy rates nor the global recession could prevent Hollywood having its best year ever in 2009. With an estimated $10.6 billion in consumer spending at the U.S. and Canadian box office, the movie industry will break the 2008 record by nearly $1 billion. The global economy is taking a major hit, and when these conglomerates that own movie studios are having a tough time, it's at least one bright spot in the equation. Paul DeGerabidian, a president of Hollywood.com box office, said in a comment, "People are still, in 2009, going to the movies in big numbers. Hollywood is far from bankrupt and more alive than ever before. In the past, box office earnings have increased significantly to reach this new record high." Of course, this doesn't mean that a lack of negative correlation between piracy and box office tickets is still proving that illegal downloads have no effect at all. It could be that the movie industry would make even more money if the plug was pulled on the internet. Then again, without any evidence, the opposite could be true, as many independent filmmakers had already experienced. BitTorrent and the internet in general can be a boon to the film industry and a potential source of revenue. Perhaps Hollywood should stop complaining and start seeing the millions of illegal downloaders as potential customers instead of thieves. There's a huge demand for online entertainment, so why not compete with piracy instead of spending millions of dollars fighting it? So on one hand, they're saying that it's worse than ever. We're losing billions and billions of dollars. They're cooperating with the U.S. government. Well, the U.S. government is cooperating with the movie industry and trying to get a task forces and funding from the U.S. government to combat piracy. But on the other hand, they're making more money than they ever made in the history of movies. So it's either one thing or the other. You can't complain about losing money when you're making more money than ever. This would never fly in any other business. If the car industry was making more money than it ever was before, would they be asking for a bailout? Would they be asking for money? And would the government give them money? That wouldn't happen. So I don't know why this flies and works for the movie industry. Can anybody explain this to me? How they can make more money than ever, but yet claim that they're losing more money than ever? Doesn't make any sense to me. This next one is sent in by DC. Privacy news from the US. Facebook founder denies being caught out by site's new privacy setting after 300 personal photos appear on its profile. This is from the dailymail.co.uk. Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg has denied being caught out by his own website's revamped privacy settings after more than 300 pictures on his page were briefly left open to the public. The website's new settings allow users to open their profile to friends, friends of friends, or everyone who uses a social networking site. And interrupt it right there, because last week, I think I reported last week about this story, and they actually recommend that you open everything to the public when you're updating your Facebook site. And of course, I set it to only friends, and everybody should go and check their privacy on their Facebook site so they can set it to only friends, because it does recommend you open it up. I'll continue on. The changes sparked by claims by privacy groups that Facebook was trying to trick its users into sharing more personal information than they normally would. Following the change on December 9th, Zuckerberg's profile was opened up, granting thousands of people access to shots of him partying with his fraternity brothers, having an office Star Wars joust with his girlfriend, and lounging around with a teddy bear. When these were picked up by a number of other websites, the Facebook entrepreneur denied he had been caught out. In a posting on his revamped webpage, he says, "For those wondering, I set most of my content on my personal Facebook to be open so people could see it. I set some of my content to be more private, but I didn't see a need to limit visibility of pics with my friends, family, or my teddy bear." However, he then changed his privacy settings so the photos were only available to friends. Zuckerberg's Facebook book picture albums before they were made private to any, and it has a picture of it on this story, and you can widely find these now private pictures after they were made public for a couple days. But you can find them on this website and lots of other websites. Privacy campaigners said the unwelcome changes by the world's most popular social networking site nudged users to share photos, private calendars, and status updates with a wider audience through search engines. Kevin Bankston from the Electronics Frontier Foundation, which champions internet users, said these new privacy changes are clearly intended to push Facebook users to publicly share even more information than before. Shortly after the new privacy settings were introduced, December 9th, blogger Kashmir Hill from the True Slant website discovered Mr. Zuckerberg's profile had become far more public. Friends of his friends can now view 300 of his previously private photos, his status updates, and details on his events calendar. This revealed, amongst other things, that Mr. Zuckerberg is a fan of Taylor Swift, likes to play with toy lightsabers, and attended a great goat roast in the autumn. Zuckerberg's the privacy changes come as internet search engines become increasingly interested in incorporating user-generated content from social media websites into their search results. Though it goes on and on and on about that. So my question is, if Mr. Zuckerberg didn't want these, if he did want and didn't care about these pictures being public, why weren't they public before? Why were they set supposedly on purpose by him to be public afterwards when he didn't have them public before? And furthering that thought, why were they made private yet again, only days later after he had been outed by the media? And it's really a bad stance for Facebook to make people choose when they log in to change and suggest that they should change to more public settings when their old settings were not the default recommended settings. If Facebook wanted to make these changes to their website, all they could do is say, we have made updated changes in Facebook's website, and you can go review your review and update if you'd like, but we've kept your old settings. But it didn't do that. It didn't. It made you log in. As soon as you log in, it has already checked off make my profile public all the way down the line. And if you haven't logged into Facebook, it's a good time now to do it and take a look at the new settings that they have recommended for you. And this is copyright news from the US. Google and Microsoft are sued over links to file sharing site. It has happened finally. The Register.co.uk reports, mini music label Blue Destiny Records has sued both Google and Microsoft for allegedly facilitating and enabling the illegal distribution of copyrighted songs. Now, a lot of people in the file sharing community have been waiting for a lawsuit just like this because Google and Microsoft have very deep pockets to fight this kind of thing. I'll continue on. Filed on Monday with the U.S. federal court in Northern Florida, the suit is an attempt to choke off the distribution of Blue Destiny tunes on the Germany-based file-sharing site RapidShare, also named as a defendant. It accuses RapidShare of knowingly running a distribution center for unlawful copies of copyrighted works, while claiming that Google and Microsoft are propping the company up. According to the suit, RapidShare benefits from ad relationships with the two search engines. RapidShare generates revenue by selling subscriptions for its high-speed downloads and through advertising dollars generated by advertising partnerships with Google and Microsoft. RapidShare's business success is accomplished only by the knowing assistance of these two top search engines, Google and Microsoft's Bing. But the overall claim is that RapidShare is able to achieve consistent prominent ranking in the search engine results that direct users to websites where illegal, in quotations, free copies of Blue Destiny's recordings may be stolen. The U.S. copyright law exempts companies from liability if they're merely linking to infringing content, but only if they're unaware of the infringement and don't receive financial benefit. The suit insists that Google and Microsoft benefit financially because they're generating ad revenue from search results. And both companies have received DMCA takedown notices requesting the removal of the links in question. As Santa Clara University prof and tech law blogger Eric Golden points out, this is hardly the first lawsuit to attack a company merely linking to infringing content on other sites. But it's unusual that the defendants have such recognizable names. There have been other lawsuits against websites for linking to infringing content, but plaintiffs usually try to avoid suing power players like Google and Microsoft, both well-funded defendants who aren't likely to roll over in this issue. Goldman writes, so it goes on. So that is the issue, that Microsoft and Google have very, very deep pockets to be able to defend themselves, and possibly they'd be able to step up in this fight of merely linking to copyrighted works, which is a cornerstone of a lot of the legal defenses against some of these torrent sites, where they don't host the content, they merely link to the content. None of the torrent sites have the content on the site. So hopefully we can see the result of this lawsuit and Google and Microsoft step up for the defense of merely linking to something and not make it illegal to link on the internet. Privacy news from the US. Ohio justices, cell phone searches require warrant. It's from New York Times. The Ohio Supreme Court said Tuesday police officers must obtain a search warrant before scouring the contents of a suspect's cell phone unless their safety is in danger. The American Civil Liberties Union of Ohio described the ruling as a landmark case. The issue appears to never have reached another state court, high court, or the U.S. Supreme Court. The Ohio High Court ruled 5-4 in favor of Antoine Smith, who was arrested on drug charges after he answered his cell phone from a crack cocaine user acting as a police informant. Officers took Smith's cell phone when he was arrested and, acting without a warrant and without his consent, searched it. They found a call history and stored numbers that showed Smith had previously been in contact with the drug user. Smith was charged with cocaine possession, cocaine trafficking, tampering with evidence, and 2 counts of possession of criminal tools. During his trial, Smith argued that the evidence obtained through the cell phone search was inadmissible because it violated the constitutional ban on unreasonable search and seizure. Smith's attorney, Craig Jequith, said the law needed to be account for technological advances. People keep their email, text messages, personal and work schedules, pictures, and so much more on their cell phones. Jequith said in a statement, I can't imagine that any cell phone user in Ohio would want the police to have access to that sort of personal information without a warrant. Today, the Ohio Supreme Court properly brought the Fourth Amendment to the 21st century. So congratulations to the attorney who defended this person in terms of the search on the cell phone. And hopefully this is upheld and extended throughout the U.S. and into Canada so that people are not searched on their technological equipment that is on them, like cell phones and their laptops, and they need a warrant to take a look into that. Everything is not open. Everything can't just be searched automatically just because they want to. And in global copyright news, this was sent in by Ryan Martin, the administrator of the Pirate Party US. This is a scrollable timeline of the secret copyright treaty, ACTA, from Michael Geist. And I've got a link to there off Michael Geist's website and also a large enlarged version of it. The anti-counterfeiting trade agreement is generating growing concern. Witness today's release of a protest letter from civil liberties groups from around the world, which I referenced earlier. As many people learn about the secret copyright treaty for the first time, I posted video talks and interviews on ACTA, but some have asked for a visual timeline to trace its emergence. And also a follow-up from last week on copyright news from the U.S. on the new moon, pirate camming of the movie of the person, of the girl who accidentally, out of the corner of the camera, videotaped a small portion of a movie. And when a woman who, etc., etc., I'll skip most of it. But the case was dropped. Let me find where it says, she's traumatized by this, says her attorney, Dominic Dulcie. This is the worst event of her life, and she wants to put it behind her. Whether or not the pressure made any difference is unclear, but Termax left a courtroom with three women today. The charge against her was dismissed after prosecutors decided not to pursue the case. Her other attorney, Howard Kavanaugh, added, "There is nothing more than a birthday party where photos were being taken. It's nonsense." Samantha Tumpak will not now face 3 years in jail, no thanks to the heartless and completely idiotic theater managers who tried to ruin her life. And I stated enough last week about that. And in Pirate Party news, there is a Pirate Party Canada meeting in Montreal for all those local to the area. And it says, thanks to our friends from Extradition, that's a band, Tuesday, 22nd of November, 2009, at 18 hours 30, we'll have our last meeting of 2009 at Cafe Campus, located at 57 Prince Arthur East. And it says, our meeting will happen, the show of Extradition and of their guests, from 1830 to 1930. The doors open at 1930, and the first part is by the humorist Kathleen Rouleau. We invite us in great numbers to attend the meeting and the Christmas party of Extradition. You can download Extradition songs via the CAPT, that's a Canadian Pirate Tracker, at pirateparty.ca. So if you want to take a listen to the band before you head out to the meeting, you can do that and download music for free there. And this is from the Director of Communications, DLS, from the Pirate Party of Canada. And the closing track today, I've got a remix of Stephen Conroy, the Australian Minister for Broadband Communications and the Digital Economy, called Conroy the Idiot. And I've linked to it to the video in the show outline in the Pirate Party Radio Forum, so you can take a look at the video, which is slightly amusing as well, but I'll put the audio at the end of the show today. So if you have any Pirate Party news, or news in general, news stories from around the world or in your area of the world in relation to any of the stuff that I mentioned today, you can send it on to piratepartyradio.com on the website and just fill in the form and click go. And I won't be here next week, but Pirate Party Radio will return on December 31st with episode number 9. So thank you for listening, and until next time, this has been James O'Brien for Pirate Party Radio.
Send a love them.
Thank you, Mr. President. My question is to the Minister for Broadband Communications and the Digital Economy, Senator Conroy. I refer to the statements made by Minister Conroy in Senate Estimates hearings on October 20, 2008, in which the Minister said that Sweden, the UK, Canada and New Zealand had mandatory internet filtering systems similar to those now being trialled in Australia. Can the Minister explain why he made this statement in the light of the fact that in not one of those countries is the filtering system mandatory, and in fact the various systems in those countries are entirely voluntary if they exist at all?
The Minister for Broadband, Communications and the Digital Economy, Senator Conroy.
Thank you, Mr. President. I thank the Senator for his question. The government's ISP filtering policy is one component, cyber safety plan, online threats, protect children from online threats. We're happy to have blacklist of prohibited internet content, happy to have online threats, filtering for a range of URLs to around 10 million, 10,000, 10,000, 125.8 million URLs, so that the impact on network performance of a larger blacklist can be examined.
Senator Conroy.
Protect children, cyber safety plan. Online threats. Some people do currently have the ACMA blacklist online threat. Some people do currently have unwanted content. The United Kingdom, Sweden, Norway, Finland, France and Canada are online threats. The government will implement unwanted content.
I'm happy to come to the anti-abortion site because people should understand what happened with the anti-abortion site. But again, you're quoting the dentist. I explained very clearly what happened. Here's what happened. The Russian mob targeted Queensland small businesses last year. And what they did was they identified the pages underneath blank websites. And what they would do is they would put a some material that would be refused classification on that site. So the dentist that people say, well, how could you possibly block a dentist? Because the Russian mob hacked the site. Well, not his site directly, but they actually entered into using his web address.
Senator Ludlam.
Thank you, Mr. President. I thank the Minister for his attempt to answer the question.